the reason I got your name was because in one of my interactions with people, I met a guy named John Taylor Gatto.
Oh.
And I asked him who he thought I should speak to. And I think you were the first person he sent.
He's a remarkable guy.
Yes.
Are you going to ask me a question?
I'm going to ask as little as I can, but I'll start it over again. There are kind of several different approaches that the older people take who I interview. One approach is that they simply tell me their biography because they already wrote it. Other times people talk to me about their formative years, which is usually when they're teenagers. What I'll do after we've finished, is I'll try to write it up in a way that makes sense to a reader so that it has a kind of flow. I doubt there'll be any problem. The older the people are, the more crafted their story becomes. The teenagers are difficult because they go everywhere without ever finishing a thought, which makes them very, vibrant. But
do you take out all the you-knows and the likes?
You know, that's an interesting point. I try to leave in as many as are useful to portray the equivocation that's there. I try to leave in the flavor. And
okay, all right. Learning starts with learning how to read. And this is the scandal of our country today, that our expensive education establishment has allowed kids to go through school and not learn how to read. English is about 85% a phonetic language, and they need to be taught phonics in the first grade. And there is no point in moving to the second grade until they know how to read. Now, the whole story is told in Rudolf Flesch's book, Why Johnny Can't Read, which came out in 1955. That was the year my first child was ready for the first grade. And I read the book and believed it and bought the books that he recommended, a phonics reader, and taught my child how to read, and then entered him in the second grade, already knowing how to read. And I did that with all my children. And that's why they have done well. And they've all got a couple of degrees and no problem in school. And it is so pitiful that children are not taught how to read. Now, in the early 1950s, this contrary system came in, which then was called look-say and is now called whole language. It's the same thing. And basically, it is teaching the child to memorize a few dozen frequently used words. Now, there's a limit to how many words a little child can memorize when he looks at the print on the page. Well, maybe a couple hundred. And this is why in our international tests, you find they score all right in the first and second grade, maybe the third grade. By the time they get to the fourth grade, they're falling way behind. They can't read. They do not know how to put together the syllables and sounds of the English language. Now, a child in a reasonably educated home, like mine, of age 5, will probably know 25,000 words in his oral vocabulary. He'll know words like grandfather and toothbrush and upstairs and helicopter and hippopotamus and so forth. And if you don't teach him the segments of the word, he can't read it. And if you're trying to teach him just the whole word, there's simply a limited number of words that he can memorize. And this is why, as they move along in school and they get books that have bigger words, they can't read. Now, I taught my children with the system that was widely used in the Chicago area, Haywingo, H-A-Y hyphen W-I-N-G-O, and very successful. And the principal of the school I put them in had lived around the world and thought you know, this was unusual, but no problem. We'll give him a test. If he passes, he goes in the second grade. And no problem. So years went on, and then my grandchildren arrived. And I wanted them to learn how to read, too. By this time, Hey Wingo is no longer published. There are no phonics books out there. They've eliminated them all. And I ended up writing my own system. And there it is. It's the best phonics reader available. And it's an authentic phonics system, which you can teach a child to read with only maybe a dozen or so words that they have to learn and memorize, like the, T-H-E. There are a few words like that they have to learn. But basically, you can have that.
Okay, I can?
Why? Yeah, I can have that. It's a phonics system, and it's simply putting it together. Now, the whole establishment went to this look-say system, and all of a sudden, overnight, something like, you know, up until probably around 1950, the standard book used in public schools was the McGuffey readers. And McGuffey wasn't a real phonics book like this, but it was phonetic. They did teach children the sounds of the words, and it was good, and it taught the American people how to read. McGuffey went out, and maybe 90% of the schools in this country adopted what is known as Dick and Jane, and they were the Dick and Jane readers. Now, a lot of it, I think, was the marketing system of the publisher, which I think was Scott Forsman, and they sent their salesmen around the country, and the McGuffey readers have no color in them, and the print is smaller, and it's a little bit harder for a kid to relate to. But the Dick and Jane were full color on every page, and big pictures, and a little bit of type in big print. And you would have to be kind of a semi-moron not to figure out what the print said after you look at the picture. For example, you'd have a seesaw, and the line underneath would say, "See Dick up, see Jane down." And that would be what they would read on that page. And you have to be an idiot not to figure that out. And say, so the child says, "Look, Mother, I'm reading." And they weren't really reading. They were guessing. It's a combination of a little bit of memorization and a lot of guessing and looking at the pictures. Now, the whole word system simply took over. And just as an example of how tremendous the whole language system was and how it took over, you see all the resources and everything. It took over the system.
I see.
And all the schools went to it. And you could see in the first grade, they made the parents and the students think they were reading. Now, my favorite story about what's wrong with this was in 2000, the George W. Bush, Al Gore presidential campaign, you know, it was a big flap and great investigations of the election in Florida. And in the Miami Beach area, when they're recounting all these ballots, they found a significant number, wasn't major, wasn't enough to change the election, but it was a significant number of people who had voted for Al Gore and the Libertarian Party. Now, you know, if you vote for two people for the same office, you cancel your ballot. And the newspaper down there did an investigation to find out why in the world anybody would vote for Al Gore and the Libertarian Party. And you look at the ballot, and the presidential candidates are all listed, and these people who are semi-literate came in and they saw Al Gore, and they put the X for him, and then they saw Libertarian, and they thought it was Lieberman. And Lieberman was the vice presidential candidate with Gore, and they thought they were voting for Gore and Lieberman. Now, if you haven't had phonics, you cannot tell the difference between Libertarian and Lieberman, because you're taught, you see the beginning and the end of the word and the approximate size, and there it is. These people couldn't read. These are grown-up people who have jobs and so forth, but really they can't read. So the beginning of learning is to be able to read. Read the great works of the English language. And we now have the majority of our population that is simply excluded from the great works of the English language. Now, when one of my grandchildren was taught first reader, and so I go to Barnes & Noble to buy her a birthday present. So go in the book department to find books that are suitable for a six-year-old. Well, all the books that are suitable content for a six-year-old are all one-syllable words. I wasn't going to buy her a book with just one-syllable words. That's all you can get. And you move on a little more. Then you find some of the classics that we all read, like Anne of Green Gables and Rebecca at Sunnybrook Farm. And you find you can buy them as they were originally written, or you can buy them in the dumbed-down version. This is what's happened to learning in this country. And you should get the latest, I don't have it here with me, but the latest report on adult literacy in this country. This is the first major survey in about 10 or 12 years. And we have about a third of our population that is basically illiterate. And I don't see how we can survive as a free country with a third of our people illiterate. They get all their information from 20-second sound bites on television. They don't read anything, and therefore they don't know anything about our heritage, our history. They haven't had the enjoyment of reading good books, and it's because of what they didn't get in the first grade. Now, people who learned how to read don't remember. I have no recollection of the first grade, but I must have been taught by the phonics method. But I have no recollection of that. However, I had it, and I made my children and grandchildren have it, and they're all doing just fine. But it is a terrible scandal. And if you look at the minority population in this country, there is no injustice that's ever done to them as great as letting them go through 12 years of school and not learn how to read. Can't even read their own diploma.
So do you want to, there's so many ways you could go with this. I want to know which way you want to take it. Do you want to go to the causes or the consequences?
Well, the consequences are obvious. The consequences are obvious. People can't read. And the causes, well, you can speculate on people's motives. I think one part of it was the marketing plan of the publisher of the Dick and Jane. It's amazing. In those years, when Dick and Jane came in, there was no federal presence in the public school system. They were all individual school districts. And yet, almost overnight, in a matter of a couple of years, maybe 80% of the schools had the Dick and Jane readers. Or the Alice and Jerry readers, which was a competitor of it. And you understand the commercial, one of the commercial advantages of this. If I sell you my first reader, I don't have anything else to sell you. I don't have any second reader. But the publishers like to sell a series. So you get the same words that are then repeated and then a few more added each year. And if you buy Dick and Jane or Alice and Jerry, you've got to go from first reader, second, third, and they can sell the series. So there's a great commercial advantage in not teaching children how to read. But that's not the whole story. People have to know. There have to be plenty of people who know what's happened and who don't do anything about it. And who maybe you like it.
Who maybe what?
Maybe like it. Well, maybe they want her people to be dumb so they can be easier led around.
John Gatto's thesis.
Yeah, well.
That it was not just sold, but enthusiastically bought.
Yeah. Well, of course, the father of modern education, John Dewey, his whole theory was that the purpose of public schools is to socialize the children. It's not to educate them to achieve their potential. He would realize. I'm sure he's written about that.
Yes.
So there may be different motives, but the result is obvious. That latest adult literacy survey is on the internet. I pulled it off just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it's depressing. It's devastating. You can't learn if you can't read.
Tell me a little bit more about what you think learning is, or the different things that learning is.
Well, I think a lot of it is reading the great books, so you get different ideas, different ways of approaching problems, different experiences, widen your horizon, and you learn in many ways. I mean, you learn from reading Shakespeare. You learn from reading all kinds of books. You broaden your experience. You enables you to cope with life. You find out what other people did. You find out how they were able to accomplish great things.
Phyllis Schlafly is not your average Midwestern woman. And she didn't become who she was just by reading the books. She didn't become the unusual person she was, is, just by reading the books that were available to everyone. How did you become what you were through a learning process that was available to everyone? How did you leverage it in such a, well, powerful way? Or however you would say you, whatever you did with it? Or are you just the particular person who absorbs things differently?
I grew up in a very hardworking family. My parents worked all the time. I thought that's what I was supposed to do. I grew up during the Depression. And at the end of the day, both my mother and my father had other projects they were working on to finish out the day. Now, when it came down for college, I always knew I wanted to go to college. Incidentally, college for women did not just start with the feminist movement. My mother got her college degree in 1920, which I enjoy telling college students. And we didn't have any money. And I went to work on my 18th birthday. Do you live in St. Louis?
No.
Well, in St. Louis, we had the largest ammunition plant in the world, colloquially known as the Small Arms Plant. The main title was St. Louis Ordnance Plant. And I went to work on my 18th birthday as a gunner testing 30 and 50 caliber ammunition. And with all the tests that you do for the government to accept ammunition, accuracy, penetration, hang fire, all these various tests. And I worked half the time 4 to midnight and the other half midnight to 8 in the morning. And then I went to college in the morning and got my degree from Washington University in St. Louis and paid my way through. And then got a master's at Harvard, saved up enough money to have a year at Harvard. And political science was a subject that fit into my schedule, and I liked it. And politics has been my hobby ever since. And so then I went to Washington. I got a job doing various types of tedious research on political subjects. And I came back to St. Louis and did likewise, and then I got married, and my husband practiced law in Alton, which is about a 40-minute drive from here on the other side of the river. So I lived in Alton, and he practiced law, and I started to have a family. And in 1952, everybody knew that was going to be a big Republican year, and it was a Democratic district, and the party came around, asked my husband to run for Congress, and he had no interest. And in the course of the conversation, somebody said, "Oh, Phyllis, why don't you do it?" So I did it. And I ran a kind of an intellectual campaign and won the primary, lost the election, and just been a volunteer in politics ever since. And one thing grew with another. My interest and activity kind of grew right along with my children. And then I was active in Republican women's clubs, and from 1960 to 64, I was president of the Illinois Federation of Republican Women. And as we approached 64, we conservatives wanted Barry Goldwater. And I had one of my little hobbies was checking up on Republican national conventions, which I find quite interesting. I've been to every one beginning in 1952, and you can see my battle ribbons on the wall as you walk out. I've been a delegate to most of them. And I figured that most delegates to a Republican convention are first-timers. The majority would be first-timers in any convention. And they needed to know what went before. So I wrote a little book called A Choice, Not an Echo, and published it myself. Who would publish a book by some unknown Alton housewife, as they called me? And I sold 3 million copies. And that's what gave me my national following. But in your learning process, I have to say one more thing, that I believe, once we assume you know how to read, the way you really learn something is to write about it. And it's not enough just to read about it. It's only when you write about it that you really have a grasp of what you're talking about.
I learned to read, but I didn't learn to write until I had to start writing.
Uh-huh.
It was a wholly different.
Oh, it's very different. It's hard work.
It's the difference between looking at a painting and painting.
Oh, yeah.
Practically.
Yeah, except that most painters enjoy their work. But most people who write, it's tedious. It's hard work. But you know the subject after you write about it.
There is still something that's not disclosed in how you learned, because either you were extremely capable or lucky, but I mean, there's a passion thing. You can read dully and you can read with being ignited. I think these are two different ways to encounter ideas. And it sounds like either you were always a passionate person, in not emotionally necessarily, but passionate in pursuit of something, or you learned to be. And this is one of the big issues that I focus on, because most kids before puberty, or where the various stages they go through when they hit adolescence, are a combination of dependent and aimless and hyperactive and unaware. And then somewhere in their 20s, they would, if they're lucky, get inspired, but most people would not, be inspired. Some people get inspired to learn or to act or to do. And I talk to some of these people who are inspired, and I ask them how they got inspired, and they don't know. They don't know. How did you go from a normal person to an abnormally capable person? How can other people do it? It's not just reading.
No, it's not. I don't know the answer to your question.
What's the question? Maybe you could restate it in ways that are meaningful to you.
How did I become passionate? How did I become an activist? It was one step at a time. I grew up a very shy person. Learning how to and I wasn't any leader. That's one of the talks I give. If I can be a leader, anybody can be a leader. I didn't grow. Some leaders are born. I was not a born leader. I was not a born social person, people person. I had to learn it all.
Why?
Why did I have to learn it? Because I wanted to accomplish certain goals. How did I learn it? Basically, running for office. I tell people to run for office. There are three results of running for office. You win, you lose, or you learn. And I learned a whole lot each time I ran. You got to relate to people. I ran for Congress again in 1970. And I had 15 counties. It was a coffee party campaign. I'd have 2 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, and 1 in the evening. They were nicely structured. We'd have our coffee and cookies for 15 minutes. I'd talk for 15 minutes and then answer questions for half an hour. That's the end. And it was a great learning process for me. I didn't win, but I learned.
You didn't read, so there's another kind of learning going on there.
Yeah, learning of dealing with people.
My son goes to a school where they don't read, or they don't read much, or they don't read yet. And they learn mostly through people. They learn to speak and to hear and to interact, which is valid. Those are things that are important. How would you, so since you've admitted there are other ways to learn, why did you choose to emphasize reading first? And maybe that's a very simple answer, but why don't you tell me, of the other kinds of reading, it doesn't stop with reading. It may start there, but you chose to start.
Well, you've
there.
Got to have something to talk about if you can talk to people. You need to read in order to have something intelligent to say.
Well, I know kids who don't read, certainly kids in other countries, that doesn't stop them from talking. So I think you are, there are things here you're not saying about the value of speaking and the purpose of speaking. Maybe it's because you, as you said, had things you wanted to do. Because some people who are inspired to learn somehow get an idea of what they want to do. It could be technical, it could be creative or expressive or interactive or defensive. They're engaged and they're pulled almost. One of the kids I've interviewed many, looked like a normal kid. He was in a program that encouraged him to read by giving him points that he could spend on something trivial like food. And because he wanted those points, he became a voracious reader, and it sort of snowballed. It stimulated his mind, and then he spread out, and In fact, the two things that seem to be the most formative in people's backgrounds, and it doesn't answer my question of how they, you know, bloomed, were their parents or some supportive mentor, usually a parent or a family, or reading, as you could appreciate. But not in a structural way like this. They just sort of fell into it, sometimes for lack of anything else to do, which is pretty valid. If you're a kid, most of what you are subjected to is pretty trivial. So, you did mention your parents.
Very important.
Tell me a little bit more about them. Or, you know what I'd like to hear, if possible, is not just parent, but the idea of a mentor, which can be a parent, but doesn't have to be. Did you have mentors who were separate from your parents, or did you look
no,
at your parents as mentors?
No. My parents. Well, as I said, we grew up during the Depression, and my father lost his job, and my mother had prepared herself not only with a college degree, but with a graduate degree in library science. And when we needed to eat, she got one job after another that she could find, and ultimately became the librarian at the St. Louis Art Museum, where she was for 25 years. And she was the mainstay support of our family, with some pitiful salary all along. My father had got a few jobs here and there, but I would say my mother was the mainstay support. And I would say the mentoring that I had was the idea that I have to get myself prepared to support myself no matter what comes after. And that's why I put so much into going to college. My classmates could have done it, but they, some of them had parents who could pay for their college, and some of them didn't care and didn't go. But I wanted to go, and I didn't have parents to pay for it. So I did what I had to do. Because the goal was to get myself prepared to support myself.
You looked at college as a professional preparation?
Yes.
Rather than based on aspiration, it was based on fear of something, deprivation? Was there an element
just
of that?
The goal of having a decent life.
Yes. Does this mean, like, better than your parents? Did you...
Well,
it's not very well explored. People don't explore this much. I'm not sure why, but if this drove you, if there should be more people like you, and this was important, why don't you tell me how other people can draw on something? Because you get so many kids who don't know where to go. Ultimately, my project is to help people either find a reason or a direction. And
well, don't waste your time. What I tell them, I was working a 48-hour week manual labor job. It took me an hour to get to work and an hour to get back. So, and then I was taking a full college course. I cannot understand what college students do with all their time. This is what I tell the college audiences. I don't understand. What do you do with all your time if you're not working a 48-hour week? Why are you wasting your time? These are your most vigorous, healthy, productive years. What are they doing?
What are they doing?
I don't know. I can't figure it out.
Really?
But it's a waste of time, most of it.
What do you think they're doing?
Oh, some of them have a few little part-time jobs, I suppose. I don't know. Maybe they're partying. I don't know what they're doing. But I think what I've done is to simply make use of all my time. I remember when one of our sons came home from college, and I said, Andy, why don't you go out with your high school pals? Yeah, they'd be glad to see you. I don't want to do that. Well, I said, why not? Well, he said, all they like to do is go out and drink. Oh, I said, how come you don't like to go out and drink? He's pretty funny, this kid. Well, he said, Mother, I've thought about this, and I think when they came home from high school in the afternoon, they saw their parents. And what do their parents do? Well, they'd sit down and they'd have a cocktail, and then they'd have a leisurely dinner. And when I came home from high school, my parents kept right on working, and I thought that's what I was supposed to do. And when I was that age and I came home, my parents kept right on working. After my mother worked her day job, she was writing a social history of St. Louis. And someday I hope to get that manuscript and get it published. It's a wonderful book. And my father worked 18 years in sitting at the desk developing a rotary gasoline engine, which he finally did patent, but unhappily never sold. But at any rate, the evenings, we just kept on working.
This is interesting. I'm surprised you don't highlight it more. It sounds like your father had a workshop.
No, it was all done on paper with drawings.
Amazing. Did he have an engineering background?
Yes.
Huh. Did your parents encourage you to learn or read to you a lot or engage you in their pursuits?
Oh, not particularly. No, they didn't read to me. I read to myself.
When did you start reading? Is it through the whole... Because school actually teaches reading pretty late. A lot of people learn earlier.
As I told you, I do not remember how I learned to read, but I assume it was in the first grade.
Really? Mm-hmm. Do you remember your parents reading to you?
No, they never read to me.
Never? No kidding. I read to my kid all the time. It's kind of standard, I think, these days.
Well, how old are they?
They?
The ones you read to.
I started reading to them, I don't know, he was five, maybe.
Well, I don't know. My answer to that is, if you want your kid to be a baseball player, do you sit him down and read him stories about baseball players, or do you go out in the backyard and throw a ball with him?
Well, I don't know. Tell me. I can't answer that question.
Well, I think you teach him how to throw and catch a ball.
He resists. It's funny. The reason he resists is because he's become habituated to long, complicated stories written in circuitous, difficult-to-follow sentences. And when I give him a book, he can't read at that level. So he, in a sense, I feel that I've got him in a mixed orientation where what he wants to do. So he'd rather have it read to him because it's more interesting than struggling through the phonetics of these four-syllable
words.
Well,
teach him how to read so he can read himself.
But you
got to give him things he likes. Now, in one set of my grandchildren, they have twin girls and a boy a year later. So the girls adapted fine to reading. The boy saw no utility in learning how to read whatsoever, because the girls like to read about fairies and princesses and kings, and there's no point in that at all. It's a waste of time. But when he found he could read about adventures and battles, then there was a utility to learning how to read.
Well, okay, two things I want to get out of you still. First, I'd like to get a story and then a wrap-up, which is a question about what you would tell kids to do, but one at a time. So, can you give me a personal story that has some, you know, not pedagogy and not philosophy and not perspective, but illustrative? Is there something illustrative you can tell me about how you learned, like in this election process or through something else that was transformational for you?
Something that would illustrate learning?
Yeah.
I don't know.
How about one of your greatest failures? Those are very... One learns a lot from them. Or successes.
I don't know what would make a good story. Of course, my fight to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment was a very exciting battle.
Preface this by explaining the Equal Rights Amendment in a paragraph. Because we're talking to kids here. They don't know what it is.
The feminist movement came into this country and captivated the media in the late 1960s. And there are a lot of things wrong with the feminist movement. But the number one thing that's wrong with it is that they teach women to believe they're victims, victims of an oppressive, discriminatory society. And that is so false, because American women are the most privileged class of people who ever lived on the face of the earth. And they told them that the solution to their victimhood was a new constitutional amendment called the Equal Rights Amendment. It's a long story. We'd be here the rest of the afternoon if I tried to tell you all about it. But they put it through Congress, and then it went out to the states, and I took on the battle, and it turned out to be a 10-year battle. And nobody thought we could stick with it for 10 years, but we did, and we finally beat them. And we beat everybody. We had Nixon, Ford, and Carter against us. We had 98% of the Congress, all the governors, all the media, all the money, all the Hollywood, and we beat them all. And one of the main reasons they lost was they never were able to show any benefit. I mean, you can wrap up a pretty package and maybe sell it to some dumb person, but over a 10-year period, if there's nothing in the package, you can't sell it. And they were never able to show any benefit. And just to give you one example of the detriments, what ERA would do is to make all of our laws, federal and state, sex neutral. And your classic example of a sex discriminatory law is the military draft. It says male citizens of age 18 must register. This came out, we're just coming out of the Vietnam War. My daughters thought this is the craziest thing I ever heard. I mean, you're going to give women an amendment. The first thing is we have to sign up for the draft like our brothers. You got to be kidding. But that's just one example. Anyway, so there were many dramatic events, and there were some defeats along the way, but ultimately we won enough victories that we won.
I want a dramatic event because I want people to know where your fiber is. See, people like you take it for granted. It's not to be taken for granted. It's this kind of strength.
We had a number of dramatic events in Illinois. Illinois was the front line of the battle. Illinois voted every year for 10 years. And I don't know how I can reduce this to some little anecdote.
You can run on. I'll edit it. You can edit it down.
I guess the most dramatic day was in 1980. And we had everything against us. All the media were there. All the networks were there. Because the feminists had said this was the day they were going to pass it. And this was the day Jimmy Carter, then president, was calling the Democrats, promising them public housing projects in their district if they would vote yes. And the governor of Illinois, who was Republican, was calling the Republicans and telling them they would get dams, roads, and bridges if they would vote yes. And the Chicago mayor, who was then Jane Byrne, was calling the the ones who were beholden to the Chicago machine, threatening that their relatives would lose all their jobs if they didn't vote yes. Grown men were weeping on that floor that day. The Chicago guys who felt they had to vote yes so their relatives wouldn't lose their job. And they voted electronically. And we had counted our votes, and we thought we were 2 votes short. And the votes went up on the electronic board, and we won. God gave us 2 votes we didn't never had before. It was a dramatic day. And Eleanor Smeal, who was the head of National Organization for Women, was there. ABC put her on the chair in front of the camera in the gallery. I was in the gallery.
What vote was this? Was it in Illinois? Illinois.
In the Illinois legislature. Said, well, Miss Smeal, you said you had the votes. Why didn't you win? And she said, there was something very powerful against us, and I don't mean people. And they fought on for a couple more years, but that was the most dramatic day.
Were you
how bad they were? They had, you know, they had a hunger strike going on in the rotunda of the Capitol with the excommunicated Mormon, and they had some experienced hunger strikers left over from Vietnam. They were lying around on couches in the hunger strike. And they had the lesbian chain gang who chained themselves to the door of the Senate chamber, and so the senators had to step over them to get into their seats. Then another bunch of them went to the slaughterhouse, and they got some plastic bags of pig's blood, and they came back and they wrote on our marble floors the names of the people they hated the most. It was really tough. And we beat them all.
Was that a personal victory?
Oh, yeah. It was a personal victory, but I had a lot of good people. I get very embarrassed when people say Phyllis single-handedly. They use that word all the time for some unknown reason. And I had lots of people. But like any movement, you have to have a leader. And I said, I didn't grow up a leader, but I learned how to become a leader. And all I did was raise the flag and say, let's march. But anyway, the feminists haven't gotten over it. Hillary Clinton's still calling for the Equal Rights Amendment. And they never were able to show one benefit, not one single thing that it will do. Of course, when they went on television, they'd say it's going to give you all a raise. But that is not true. Remembering again that what it would do is to make all the laws sex neutral. And the employment laws are already sex neutral.
So is it just another Dick and Jane story of someone who sees advantage trying to institute it? Or is there...
It was a fraud. It was a fraud. It was just dishonest.
And, do you see a social need that it catered to?
No, but if you try to make people believe they're oppressed and mistreated and not paid what they ought to be paid, that's kind of an easy thing to do. I mean, everybody probably thinks he's worth more than he's being paid.
You know, I'll just mention this, a slight detour, but a number of the people I've interviewed are Native American. The previous generation of Native Americans, who are now elders, were the brunt of a lot of racist programs. And their reaction is often categorized as feeling victimized. The current generation, now in their 40s, seem to reject the victim attitude of their parents and identify it as a very weak and sort of static, stagnant approach, which I think you could relate to.
Well, they may
picture.
Accomplish something if they get rid of their victimhood.
It may be what?
They may accomplish something.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's what the younger generation says.
You wake up in the morning with a chip on your shoulder, you're not going to succeed.
Well, maybe this ties into the question of learning. Empowerment or being empowered or disempowered. I think learning does take real learning, inspired, the kind of learning that you don't need fuel for, that you have your own fuel, inspiration. It takes something that's not taught, maybe not recognized, and most of the time not accomplished either. It's not many people who can take off. I think a lot more people could. I'm not sure why not everybody could, but maybe there are reasons. And I think it would be a better world if more people were inspired. Can you say, finally, what would you tell, these kids who are making that transition from being dependents legally, and to independence or self-sustaining, self-possessed, of how they could do it? How could they make the most? So reading it has applied to younger kids mostly, but even knowing how to read is no insurance. So if you go up the age group to adolescence, is there anything you could tell the kind of normal, lost, not deeply lost, but maybe just practically lost, functionally lost kids, as to what they could do to fuel their minds?
Well, I think attitude is simply the key part of it. And they should be so grateful that they live in the greatest country in the world, where they have the opportunity to do whatever they want, where we have so much freedom, where we have so much prosperity. That's why everybody in the rest of the world wants to come here. And make what you want to of your life. It's attitude, I think, is absolutely key. And there are just an awful lot of people who have the attitude that they are mistreated or unfairly treated. You know, that's the way the feminists build their ranks. They have a very widespread technique they call consciousness raising. And they get a bunch of women together, and then they exchange their stories of how badly some man has treated them. And as I tell the college students, grievances are like flowers. If you water them, they will grow. So little grievances grow into big grievances. And that's their whole technique. And it's so unfortunate. Everybody's got problems. And there's sin in the world. And move on and make your life what you want it to be. Okay.
Can I take a picture?
Sure. You want somebody to take it with you, or you just want a picture of me?
Just want a picture of you.